Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 1st of September 2018, Episode 2. Just quietly reading through this. We're in the in-brief section, so there's no authors put with this. Now, what I was going to say, the last one was about parrots. This sort of like they've got five species of parrot, and they're seeing which species is the most commercial, and it's sort of like a longbow. But it's interesting for in terms of I suppose tuning what you do to get the maximum publication out of it. It's just sort of like the fundamental aspect of research, i.e. that you research with an eye for failure, and interpreting your degree of failure for the maximum amount of information and papers you get out. I think it's an overall healthy idea. This article is titled, Just One Sleepless Night Can Prime the Body to Store Fat. Oh my god, you better get sleep. One night without sleep may be enough to make your body start storing extra fat and lose muscle. This help explains why people with insomnia and shift workers with disrupted sleep patterns are particularly prone to obesity and type 2 diabetes, says Jonathan Cedrains of Uppsala University in Sweden. Well, that would be really good. Something which is where they found out about exercise was the bus drivers, double-decker bus drivers in the insurance. They found that the bus drivers had a huge heart rate attack, whereas the conductors, the fare collectors who used to go up and down the bus, had a much lower death rate. Now, that's for me is one of the statistics, an example of statistics that you may have a different grade of people who require less training to get into it. That the bus drivers, besides exercise, the bus drivers also were sitting down and getting a different type of vibration. And they have found that truck drivers suffer from heart attacks a lot more for vibrations, and they've tracked down the vibrations. There's a little truck driver story I do have to tell you about how the truck drivers in Australia campaigned to increase, with the industry support, to increase the length of their cabins so they can place the engine out, because they're sitting on top of the engines, as they do in those British buses. You're sitting right next to the engine. The extra vibration they claimed and researched caused heart conditions. And so what they did is the government said, fair dinkum, everyone's agreed, the public, the medical professionals, the industry, everyone, it's a win-win situation. We're going to increase the legal length of a truck in Australia by, I don't know, 1.5 metres, whatever it is, length, so you can sit back behind the cabin and look after it. And so the truck drivers, the industry immediately then just bought longer trucks with the people still sitting up the front. They just, at no point, there's not even the slightest feeling that, hey, did you not hear all that history going across? And of course, there you go. And of course, there'd be insiders in the writing the legislation. And of course, all the cardiac rehab places have heaps of truck drivers in it. He and his colleagues took fat muscle samples from 15 healthy young men on two separate mornings, one after a good night's sleep and the other after they lay awake all night. What a fantastic thing. This is good. After a sleepless night, the patient's muscles showed signs of protein breakdown. Their fat tissue, in contrast, was found to have elevated levels of proteins and metabolites that were involved in promoting fat storage. Staying awake all night also appeared to change the expression of several genes in fat tissues that were associated with obesity and type 2 diabetes. Well, there you go. As I talk about sort of dodgy research, as you always do. Look, when you first come into an area, it's very dodgy. But here, these Swedes have nailed it. These findings fit with previous research showing that sleeping for just 4 hours a night for five consecutive nights can trigger weight gain. Sleep restriction may mess with the metabolism by disrupting normal hormonal cycles, said Sedrains. Hormones involved in muscle maintenance, such as growth hormone and testosterone, are primarily produced during sleep, while cortisol, which promotes fat storage, is mostly released when we are awake. The researchers are now investigating whether specific diet or exercise plans could use to counteract these effects. Okay, so they're wanting me to do more intense exercises. I can sort of muster hours of walking, but that's not necessarily good for me. Okay, new way to catch water from the air. I love this type of stuff. A nanofiber cloth could help drought-hit communities and capture drinking water from the air. Fog nets usually consist of polythene mesh strung between poles. Water vapor condenses on the small fibers that trickles down into bottles. However, the yield is often limited and the water only flows on foggy days. And this means that the nets are restricted to mountain regions where fog is common. Sing Chung Wong of the University of Akron in Ohio and his team created a new material using electrospun polymers, a technique that, I wonder what electrospun is, to create nanoscale fibers. These are tangled around fragments of expanded graphite. Oh, I do know what expanded graphite is. You can actually put graphite layers in your microwave oven and in a soup and heat it up and you get this really fluffy expanded graphite. So that's, will I remember? Electrospun, expanded graphite, I'll have to look at those now. Okay, I was going to say, if you listen to the Podation podcast I've just done before, I'll be thinking, I'll be back to look at it. So I can sort of see sort of a multiple way of doing it, the advanced podcast of the future. The fibers provide less surface area for the vapor to condense onto. The graphite encourages the water to drip out of the material, i.e. it's water repelling. Wong says such harvests could yield six times as much water as current systems. He envisages using a battery to cool an element attached to the material which would encourage water to condense out of dry air, such as in deserts. The findings are presented at the meeting of Chemical Society of Boston. Well, you know what I think? I think why not just go one further and if it forms a fog, it's a tiny little droplet. Yeah, you can charge those and just get them to funnel into your cup. You can just suck fog out. But you can actually... Yeah. This is interesting. NewMap gets contents right at last. And here's Australia as big as the United States. Except the United States, you've got Alaska sitting up there, which tips you bigger than Australia. I don't know how Australia gets bigger than the United States, I'm not quite sure, but it looks bigger. A new kind of world map has been developed to show the true size of continents without warping their shapes too much. The most familiar map, called the Mercator Projection, that's from a Portuguese person, it was created way back in 1569, but it generally distorts the relative areas of land masses, making Africa look much smaller than it is, while Greenland and Russia appear huge. There have been numerous attempts to solve this, but the problems are all for them. For instance, the Robertson projection with the curved size is much better than the Metcalfe, but it still doesn't show the areas accurately. Last year, schools of Boston began using the Gauss-Peter map, wall maps, and accurately show, well, there you go, Gauss-Peter, and show the relative areas of continents, but greatly distort their shapes. The controversy caused among cartographers spurred California software engineer Bojan Sarvi and others to create a new equal Earth projection. Isn't that beautiful? Sarvi and others, it looks similar to the Robertson map, but actually shows the relative areas. In isolation, it may not appear much difference to the Metcalfe apart from the curved size, but side by side, big differences relative sizes of the land masses are clear. People who work with maps seem to like it. Quote, It nicely balances several competing criteria, including aesthetics, wrote the mathematician Cook in a blog post. NASA has already started using it to show global temperatures in July. Yep. I'm just looking at it. Okay, well, I've spotted one problem with it already. I don't know whether it is. I have to get my glasses. I don't know whether zero goes through Greenwich. It's interesting that Greenwich is not at zero meridian because they got it wrong, because they assumed that the gravity points to the center of the Earth, and it doesn't. So they're out by, I don't know, 20, 30 meters, Greenwich. Meantime, their line is incorrect, because the Earth is not a plumb bob doesn't point to the center of the Earth, it points to the net gravitational gradient of the area, which means that if you go up in space, you get a better idea of the plumb point pointing downwards, and therefore you get Greenwich at a different point. Meet your microbes. Insight biome sequencing. And it's by Alan Klein. Investigates. Is paying to sequence your gut bacteria worth it? Oh, God. Alice Klein investigates. Yeah, with all these sort of things, there's certain people who just automatically assume it's all worth it. And there's a lot of people standing in the queue going, hey, sequencing your genome is so 2017. I love it. That's exactly my feeling. Oh. With personalized health becoming a booming industry, several startups are now offering to sequence the DNA of all your microbes living in your guts as well. Emerging research that cultivating a healthy balance of these organisms, collectively known as the gut microbiome, this is interesting. It's not a microbiome in terms of that's a small area. Micro, it's not a biome is micro, it's the biome of the microbes. It's sort of like a horse biome. Sort of what? It can protect against some of the biggest health threats around, including obesity, diabetes, heart disease, irritable bowel disease, arthritis, and depression, as you do. So I'm just going to think what the Swedes did to get a good night's sleep and have your guts sequenced. We might be able to control the organisms with drugs, but the firm thinks food is a better option. These companies say they can provide tailored dietary advice to improve your mix of good and bad gut microbes and optimize your health. However, researchers are saying that the science might not yet be robust enough to help healthy, health-conscious consumers. Quote, it's a big leap from identifying which microbes are there to knowing how to manipulate them to improve your health, says Amy Logman of Deakin University in Australia. Oh, look, I have to apologise for us Aussies. The first company to offer gut microbiome sequencing direct to the consumers was the US firm Ubiome, founded in 2012. Firms like Thrivery in the US and Atlas Biomed in the UK soon began offering similar services. So did two crowdfunded research projects, American Gut and British Gut. These early tests used a sequence called the 116 ribosomal RNA analysis to determine the types of bacteria in the customers' stools and hence their guts. They could only identify broad categories of microbes, however, because the technology sequences just a small part of the overall biobacterial genome. More recently, a method called shotgun metagenomics has made it possible to drill down further. It sequences the full genomes of many microbes in a stool, letting you, your healthy individual species, identify healthy. In addition, picking out bacteria, it also detects other microbes that may influence gut health, such as fungi, archaea and viruses. So archaea is the ones that give you the smelly farts, the sulfurous farts, the methane. In 2016, Israeli company Day 2 launched the first consumer version of this new metagenomics test based on research by the Weizmann Institute of Science and UBIM, then began offering a similar test in January this year. And an Australian company, Microbar, founded by biologists at the University of Queensland, followed in July. Each company sells tests for around $300 US. They send out the home stool collection kits by post and extract a sequence of DNA with the customer sample before using metagenomics to, you'd think that you'd want to actually do this with, combine this with bowel screening to get some beautiful information. Bacteria cultured from human feces. Oh. I don't know why that's there. To decode the thousands of microbial species present in the eubiome gives customers a simple readout of microbes detected along with information about what they do inside your body, such as producing vitamins. Day two, microbia go further, provide personalized dietary advice based on the microbes they find. Day two says it can identify foods that will help control blood sugars and thus protect against diabetes. It'd be interesting if they give the same advice regardless of the test. And heart disease. Foods it's recommended are different for everyone as they are based on each individual's mix of gut microbes. Well, it is different, but that's not sufficient to say that they're correct. To offer this advice, the firm uses algorithms developed by the Weizmann researchers. In a study published in 2015, they found that people responded differently to identical meals because of their unique gut biome. For example, some people had higher blood sugar spikes after eating sushi than eating ice cream. Tell this to people who are starving. God. Oh, I think I'll eat sushi. No, I'll have the ice cream. There is actually a yogurt sushi shop in Jordan Springs. If you come out to Australia, don't go past some of our really boring new suburbs and visit the new supermarkets built in the desert, so to speak. And go to Jordan Springs for the sushi yogurt shop. Using data from 800 people, researchers trained the machine learning algorithms, that's what you have to do, the black magic thing, to predict the best blood sugar lowering diets for each individual based on their set of gut microbes. They validated it in a follow-up trial of 26 people. Quote, "It's probably the most evidence-based of the tests so far," says Longman. Oh, God. Microba takes a broader approach. It offers dietary advice to boost 17 types of bacteria associated with reduced risks of developing a range of diseases. For example, it measures the level of fecal bacterium porzanesium, which is thought to protect against bowel cancer and inflammatory disease. If customers are below average levels, the company recommends eating blueberries, watermelons. Well, firstly, I can't eat blueberries, or too many blueberries, I've got to have Wolfram. Asparagus, broccoli, and other foods containing nutrients. Can I have watermelon? I want someone if there's, what's in watermelon? It is unclear whether this will actually make much difference to your health. Quote, "It's a good start, but there are thousands of other bacteria in our guts as well. We're only just beginning to understand which ones are important and how they work. But it will take you $300 anyway." This is Longman. Oh, that's me adding. "In most cases, it won't be a single species driving one disease." I like the authority. Microbe can't conduct clinical trials to validate its dietary recommendations, yes. But it plans to recruit customers to follow up studies. Quote, "At the moment, the test should be mainly treated as like a neat information tool. We're not at the point where we can diagnose or treat disease," says Alinda Preble, one of the company's biologists. Preble says microbia services do help people by explaining why they should be eating certain foods. Quote, "Well, they don't need their poo tested. We're all told to eat more fruit and vegetables, but we don't know why most of us don't," she says. "If you know eating blueberries will promote the exact bacteria that you are deficient and potentially protect against disease, that might be less motivating, because it's just strawberries and blueberries and gluten Australian, so it's like they're just dumping strawberries here. Rob Knight of the University of California, San Diego says the tests, quote, "have, quote, tremendous potential, but advises treating it with caution for now. Quote, I don't think we know enough yet to make the personalised dietary recommendations with great confidence, he says. Some customers have already questioned the reliability of the test after getting contrasting results on the different services. That's what you have to do, don't you? For example, Tammy Lieberman of Harvard University blogged about getting different results from Ubiome and American Gut after sending them to separate portions of the same stool. Well, it's obviously stool dependent. You'd have to actually randomly put your stool in a blender, I think. Other customers have reported receiving contradictory nutrition guidance from different firms. For example, a recommendation to drink coffee and red wine in one case, and advice to avoid them in another. Well, you're stuffed. I advise that customer not to listen to any advice. These discrepancies most likely come down to different methods used to prepare the sample, extract the sequence of DNA, and interpret the data this night. God. He recommends choosing companies with testing protocols that have been validated through research rather than those undisclosed proprietary methods. Is he the research-based one? We think, well, what I'd like to do is give them crap 3 days in a row. It's increasingly interested in the microbiome's health. There is a risk that some companies will make over-inflated promises, says Logman. We have already seen that happen with genome sequencing firms, some of which make questionable claims about being able to pick the perfect workout or aromatic partner for the DNA, for the customers based on the DNA. This is a disease of affluence. Like, if you're ugly and old like me, it's ridiculous. It's ripe for some kind of thing because there's so much money in the public interest at the moment in gut health, she says. For the time being, Knight says the microbiome sequencing should be viewed as a fun science project rather than a reliable way to enhance your health. Quote, if you're interested in the process of discovery and finding out more about who you are and what's inside you, then go for it, but not a way to overcome health problems yet. He says, and I just don't think it's mentally healthy to be interested in yourself that much, because you're only going to be alive for so long. Do you actually want to say, look back on your life? Oh, I'm about to die now. What did I do in my life? I worried about myself the whole of my life. Good God. Nevertheless, both Knight and Logman are optimistic that gut biome sequencing will help people improve their health in the future. Once we know more about the role of individual microbes, how they work together, and how they can be manipulated to prevent or treat disease, quote, I think this is a start of something that could be extremely powerful, quote, says Longman. Well, here's an aisle on a sub-article on gut medicine. Rather than fine-tuning our gut microbes with food, see the main story, we may be able to do it with drugs. The US company Synthetics Biologics, for instance, is developing a microbe-modifying drug to help people with irritable bowel syndrome that stops the gut bacteria called the Methanobrevibacter smithii. Well, sorry for anyone called Smith, but methane, I bet it produces methane farts. From producing excess methane gas, which can cause bloating, constipation, abdominal pain, and explosive farts. So I've added that one. So that's a archaic bacteria. Early clinical trials found that the drug relieved the symptoms of irritable bowel syndromes, and larger trial planned this 6 year. I think that's really mad. The French company Enterome is developing a drug to treat Crohn's disease. It stops the harmful E. coli bacteria from reaching into the gut wall and triggering inflammation, which is one hallmark of the condition. The drug was shown to be safe in preliminary clinical trials and is due to undergo a larger trial this year. Dairy treatment. Modifying microbes should also help with lactose intolerance. A drug being developed by Ritter Pharmaceuticals of US simulates lactobacterias and other bacteria in the large intestine to break down lactose as it passes through. An early study found the drug allowed people with lactose intolerance to consume dairy products without any abdominal pain. A large trial is now underway. Well, yeah. I suppose I live in the world of the 1970s with starvation. These drugs are more sophisticated than the probiotics and fecal transplants, which have previously been used to alter the gut biome. Probiotics simply introduce good bacteria into the gut, while fecal transplants contain a mix of bacteria from the healthy donor's stool. This is mad. Call of the Hunt comment by Mark Bakoff. The first grizzly bear shoot in Wyoming for decades is immoral and unscientific. Also pretty bad if you're a grizzly bear. Some people enjoy killing other animals for recreation. Love that. Love that statement. Straight out of New Scientist readers will not like this whatsoever. In the latest example, 21 of the more than 70,000 applicants who entered a lottery permit will, barring the late legal decision, be allowed to kill grizzly bears near the Great Ten at Yellowstone National Park, Wyoming, from the 1st of September. The move is a result of these carnivores no longer being protected by the Endangered Species Act. Many bear biologists and other familiar with bear behaviour, ecology, reproductive physiology and population dynamics are wary about the hunt, even if not all are anti-hunting. Supporters of the shoot are playing a questionnaire number game based on the past population games. They also argue it raises conservation case, but a tiny fraction is of that from tourism. Okay, so it's much better to actually see a bear and come back to it. To see a bear, shoot it, that gets rid of it. At the moment, there are around 700 bears in and around the park. So that's 700 too many bears. Up from the estimated 136 in 1975 when they were put on the endangered species list. Many biologists are concerned that 700 is not a sustainable population. In addition, numbers aren't growing because the climate change is hitting the bears' food, such as cutthroat, trout and white bark pine trees and their nuts. There will also be, quote, collateral damage. It's highly likely that other bears will be harmed or died, including the cubs of hunter animals and those due to be born in the winter. Slaughtering the bears does not qualify, quote, as killing in the name of conservation, nor is it killing in the name of coexistence. Just 38 people out of 100 million visitors to Yellowstone will have injured grizzly bears since 1980. Rather, it is killing for fun. So in addition to being bad biology, the hunt ignores the ethics of killing. You don't say. sentient beings of for recreation animals who will suffer greatly. What's more, losing even one bear could rob the park visitor of a chance to see a grizzly. Well, not the one who shoots it, hopefully. The worry is that bears in the park will be drawn to hunt areas. Wildlife photographer and advocate Thomas will be drawn. Wildlife photographers and advocate. The worry is that bears in the park will be drawn to the hunt areas. Oh. Wildlife photographer and advocate Thomas Maxson notes that they consider a gunshot as a dinner bell rather than something to avoid because they know there may be remains to scavenge or may simply be drawn by the scent. Dinner! I'll have to tell a story. I had a close shave with a bear in Algonquin Park. This could be include the Grand Teton Park iconic bear 399. Oh, what a great bear. She has already lost around half of her 17 descendants. most probably as a result of conflict with people, says Manson, who followed her since 2006. Against McGraw, Manson applied for and won a permit to shoot in protest, but as of course he won't be using it. Virtuous option is to let the bears live. They don't belong to hunters, and trophy hunting is a gratuitous violence. Killing bears to protect bears is inane. It's immoral and inappropriate conservation practice. The upcoming hunt is not for conservation, nor is it humane. There's no reason to do it. This person doesn't really like it, doesn't know. You poor Americans, you're living in a world of Donald Trump and heaps of guns. Funeral way. Should the ban on vaping on buses and in offices be lifted, said Lara Williams. E-cigarettes and vaping started as a more palatable way to stop smoking than nicotine-laced gums and patches or hypnosis. However, what began as a surrogate for smoking now has its own mainstream culture. And while smoking is portrayed as a nasty habit to be discouraged by members of parliament, in the UK are urging rules on vaping to be relaxed, to make it acceptable in more places. In its recent report on this, the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee extolled the role of e-cigarettes as an aid to quit smoking. It wants vaping to be made easier, including discussions about allowing it in places where it's banned, such as on buses and in trains. We are ready to share a carriage with a second-hand fuck. I don't know what it means. Various studies say inhaling vapor as an e-cigarette user is probably not risk-free. Researchers at the University of Birmingham, UK, found that vapor can disable immune cells in the lungs, for example. However, the consensus is the risk is much smaller than that from tobacco, like vanishingly small, I would say. But what about passive vaping? Proof of smokers' harms help usher in bans on tobacco use in public spaces, workplaces and more. Similar vaping bans are largely a hangover from this. Goonies reports see secondhand vapor as an issue of a taste rather than health. However, a 2014 study found that e-cigarette pollutants, quote, could be a health concern for users and secondhand smokers. Another in the same year found using e-cigarettes indoors may, quote, expose non-users to nicotine, quote. On the other hand, Public Health England this year concluded, quote, there have been no identified health risks of passive vaping to bystanders. The NHS view is similar. I would think so. I just think it's just, you know, consuming drugs. Why not read a book? Why don't you? Smoking is at a low in the UK, and there's little denying the role of e-cigarettes in that. And yet I find it hard not to be cynical about the vaping industry. It's still hawking addictive products and should be viewed with scepticism. The evidence of passive vaping is hazy at best, and little to support the idea that vaping bans are a barrier to quitting smoking. I find it hard to see any benefit to relax the rules, and if there is the option not to be caught in a cloud of flavoured vapour while I'm on a bus, I like it. So this is in the comment section. Oh my god, this is the autism section. And 33 minutes. Do robots help autistic kids? The jury is still out. I think this is by Timothy Revell. From backflips to public debating, robots have been grasping new tasks with expressive rate of late. And one such task, drawing increasing attention, is helping children with autism to improve their social skills. The logic goes that a robot can be programmed to be consistent in their responses. Making a good social coach. Now, this is one of the things that I suppose I get on. I just listen for inconsistent responses I get thrown by, whereas I don't know. Acting credibly on this idea is a new study claiming that children with autism showed improved social skills after coaching sessions from a robot. Brian Sassatay of Yale University and his colleague arranged for 9 children with autism between 6 and 12 complete the 30-minute session with a robot every day for 30 days. Now, that's impressive, because normal children couldn't do that. The robot pictured above helped the children to play a touchscreen game designed to teach emotional and social understanding. Oh, God. For example, one game would you do with and without the robot, with a human... For example, one game, the robot would tell a story and ask the child to choose what they think his different characters on the screen are feeling. The difficulty was increased to cater for the children's progress, and the narratives became longer and more complex. Throughout the task, the robots would maintain eye contact with the child to show engagement and look at the screen when the child was doing the same. Sessions were conducted with caregivers at home. Scacciatelli's team found that after the experiment, the children had improved social skills. An improvement was still evident a month later. Quote, this is just so bad science. The hope is that robots might provide cost-effective, fun, engaging therapy, says Sachetti. So you really have to compare the improvement anyway with the controls and all this type of stuff. However, like many studies looking at robots and autism, a number of participants were so small that it's hard to draw a definitive conclusion. Quote, the absence of studies with large samples make it very difficult to know whether any one current robotic system works for autistic children and what will and that it works, and says Liz Parker of Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. In medicine, randomized control trials have long been the gold standard of testing interventions. In the case of using robots, this would involve randomly putting children into two groups. One group would complete robot coaching, the other would do something similar without the robot. That way, the differences that show up between the groups can be attributed to each method. That's what I was saying, basically. Quote, what we want to know is whether this sort of robot-assisted interaction is at least as good or even better than human-led interaction, and, in particular, which sort of children, since the robots won't necessarily appeal to every autistic child, says Pelicano. But, in this study, and many others, there were no control groups, making it difficult to determine if the changes seen are simply as a result of trying something new or due to the robot. Scacciatelli and his colleagues recognize many of the shortcomings and say they want to introduce randomization control groups as well as extending the study length. Robots could be excellent social coaches for children with autism, but unfortunately nobody has yet done the studies to really find out. So my sister is involved in the ethics, university ethics. She's actually supposed to give occasional lectures on it, and that type of study wouldn't get up in Australia. This is a picture of Rampo Lake. Violet, magenta, scarlet, emerald. The algae blooms revives the Dead Sea in northern China into a Narthus palette. Usually found in oceans, the algae species Denosalina is made up of the most salt-tolerant complex eukaryotic cells ever discovered. The cells usually... Algae is eukaryotic? Okay, yes, I suppose it is. The cells usually appear green, but intense environmental stresses trigger them to produce colourful pigments called carotenoids. The Yucheng Salt Lake in Shaanxi, northern China, is exposed to intense light and heat every summer. Combined with the lake's high salinity, this supercharges the metabolism, causing it to produce large amounts of harmful oxidizing free radicals as byproducts. Carotenoids are powerful antioxidants, so making them in parallel helps spare the cells from damage. Okay, I sort of see that. The lake has been in full colour since June, becoming a major tourist spectacle, but all's not well beneath the surface. As the bloom spread, it deprives the lake of oxygen and nutrients, endangering the lives of the lake's other inhabitants. So, Denisalina has previously put on similar displays in other salt lakes elsewhere, including in Turkey, Iran, and Australia. It's exported commercially around the world to produce colourings for food and cosmetics. Well, there you go. That's a really interesting, very beautiful picture here. Very beautiful picture. So, that's interesting. Imagine putting that on your face. I'm going to stop this. The next article for episode 3, I'm going to have probably do this in 4 four shots is the cover story, Halting Evolution. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.